First of all, thanks for coming, thanks for having me. I'm Christian Boonstra. I lead the Genetics of Adaptation and Aquatic Systems Working Group here. I also want to applaud the student organizers for the Public Sustainability Week.
Okay, but now to the topic. So the English topic would translate into coral reefs in climate change, ways out of the ecological collapse. That's actually me on a little dinghy in the middle of nowhere, and in the background or in the water you can see the reefs. So this appears to be beautiful for everybody, and this is basically what is at stake. And what I'm trying to convince you is worth saving, and that there are also ways to save it, okay? We don't need to put the head in the sand. But briefly, and this is actually for the students among you, you don't have to start in marine science to end up in marine science, okay? I started very traditionally in fruit flies and made my way up to mouse genomics. I actually learned a lot of genomics and bioinformatics there, which was good because by the time I transferred to the Caribbean to work on coral reefs, I could do something that very little people could do in that field. So this is always good that you have something that you like and that you're good at and that other people are not so good at yet. So I basically transitioned at a time when there was this molecular or sequencing revolution. Nowadays, you can pretty much sequence your genome of choice for your pocket money, but back in the days, this was an unattainable dream. Then I spent 10 years in the Red Sea, and you can pretty much see the difference between the reefs, right? You don't need to be a coral reef expert in this. Since April 2019, I'm here, and I'm, as I said, I lead this Genetics of Adaptation Aquatic System, so I am starting off with a fruit fly. I ended up being a coral reef biologist at the freshwater lake, okay? So what does it mean for you? You pretty much cannot plan your academic career, but you should pursue your dream and yeah, you like it what you're good and you're good at what you like is basically my bottom line to it. Okay, but back to coral reefs. You've probably also seen this picture. So that's a NASA satellite of the Great Barrier Reef. So coral reefs as this whatever big message is the only living organism you can see from outer space. And this is basically how these coral reefs look like from Earth's orbit. If you zoom in closer, it's actually important to understand that they are literally deserts in the ocean. And this is actually a proverbial quote taken from Darwin. So he was very interested in coral reefs also back in his days. Diving didn't exist. I doubt that you had underwater goggles. So that must have been all from surface observations. But so we have about 300,000 square kilometers of coral reefs on this planet, or we had 300,000 kilometers of square kilometers of coral reefs. So it's a fraction of the ocean surface. And if you yet see, zoom closer, is again, you can pretty much see, I mean, even the non-expert can probably spot easily 30 to 50 different species. So pretty much 25 to 30% of described marine species depend on coral reefs at one point in their life. But then, of course, you're also familiar with pictures like this. Well, first of all, coral reefs are probably not so important for German citizens. But across the rest of the world, this is actually a lower estimate. So the current estimate is upwards of 1 billion people. So 1 Milliarde are reliant on functioning coral reefs for goods and services. And basically fish, so protein, a source of protein. Then you can see this upper right. This is actually Egypt. It already looks pretty bad. If you go there in person, I think it's actually much worse. So each coral pinnacle, as we call it, is supposed to have to endure 100,000 to 1 million underwater enthusiasts per year. So it gives you an idea that these animals actually must be pretty resilient, right? I mean, imagine 1 million people coming through your apartment in Konstanz each year. it would be pretty devastating. But anyway, so it's a source of income. And the last picture in the lower right is basically what you can see. It's that it's also a barrier for storms and hurricanes. Again, it's not something, well, now we experience it actually in the North Sea, but in the Caribbean, for example, or in islands, this is a very big topic. And the energy that they reduce from wave action is basically equivalent to a nuclear bomb per year. So they take out massive wave energy that then doesn't hit the land. Okay, so coral reefs are important, but they are also locally threatened. So this on the left half is a picture I took on a expedition. I don't know the English word, Vermüllung, I would say in German. Like, it's really crazy that apparently we produce a lot of trash and we throw it everywhere. Then, of course, we have sewage. So as it happens, humans need water. So humans are usually, you can find a lot of people near rivers or near oceans. And this is actually a picture from California, which has nice beaches, and yet they have a lot of sewage. And then you have this crazy local construction. So who's familiar with Palm Jumeirah? It's this artificial island in Dubai where the billionaires essentially buy their weekend mansions. So all of this is basically full of houses, and you have water access, and they started this construction. First of all, it's not clear if they actually build it on top of coral reefs, because you need a foundation, so it's very hard to get information for this. Whoever is a hacker can try to get reliable. I mean, they must have done environmental impact assessments, but they are not open to the public. But anyway, so the fun story is that the millionaires were not happy because the water was stinking, okay? And they basically forgot to add these little water needs to circulate, though this was actually edited hurdle, okay? So it was a billion-dollar a stinky trash can that they now converted. Okay, and then we also have this global threat. You are all familiar with that. I hope I don't need to convince anyone. But why I like this graphic is because it actually shows you how much you can overlay the temperature anomaly to the atmospheric CO2 concentration and to the man-made carbon emissions. This is really basically a one-to-one overlay. What fewer people know is that a lot of this excess heat that is triggered by this carbon emissions is actually absorbed by the oceans. So it's really ocean warming, not earth warming, or climate change is really a problem of the oceans. So it would be a much hotter place if it weren't for the oceans. Okay, so finally we come to my topic. So this ocean warming triggers something that is called coral bleaching, Korallenbleiche, and it looks like this. So this white thing that you see is actually a coral skeleton, and there is a colorless coral tissue on top of it. So these things are not dead. They are not dead yet, I should say. It's basically, so the coral cnidarian animal, but the reason it lost its color is because corals are actually pretty smart animals. They learn to live like a plant, so they house tiny plant cells, so algae, inside their tissues, which you can pretty much see here, these golden cells, and they do photosynthesis, and basically a lot of their sugars that they produce during photosynthesis they provide to the coral, and the coral can then build the skeleton. And this gives rise to these underwater jungles, so to say, or habitat for other species to live on. So what happens during bleaching, I think, is actually reasonably well understood now. This was really very heavily researched for the last 20 or 30 years, and we did a lot in our lab. This is not what I'm talking about, this cell biological entity or dimension. What I'm going to talk about is more or less this here, so that this is essentially the tragedy of the corals, right? If you corals are so well adapted to their temperature surroundings that even a little temperature increase already triggers this break up or breakdown of symbiosis that we then call dysbiosis, And this 1 to 2 degrees, I mean, you are all familiar with the current climate change projections. So even under the most benign 1.5 scenario, which we pretty much already missed, I think it would still mean a lot of bleaching for corals. Yeah. So even if this were all true, it would still be bad news, and we had to research this. So of course, corals bleach, and you could argue that this is a natural cycle, and there is some truth to it. I just think the scale of what happens is a bit odd. And this is basically, I was privileged or entitled enough to go on a sailing expedition for 2 years around the Pacific. So this is, the idea was really to, and this was pretty much just concluded and the first set of papers was published, but the idea was to, in the steps of the big explorers, to actually do this, okay? And this is super cool because there's still a place for this in research, that you can actually go out and discover. One thing that we discovered is this number here, so that's maybe goes too deep, but based on the samples we collected, you could actually assess the bacterial diversity, and alone what you find in coral reefs is pretty much 20% of the total estimated diversity, so it's probably much higher. And if you work or if you're busy with organismal biology, this is the common thing, right? There's always more species to discover. But what this also means is every species we lose, it's a unique evolutionary path that you can basically never bring back. So everything that was evolved with this species is gone. Okay, so the scale of this expedition was crazy, and so I wasn't on there for 2 years, obviously. I think my employer would have fired me, but I was there for 2 legs for 6 weeks, and like I also got lucky enough to go into this place where I really wanted to go, though this yellow down there is basically really in the middle of nowhere. So this is a coral reef that is, it's actually the coral reef that is furthest away from all direct human impact. Okay, so I wanted to see how do coral reefs look like where humans have not never been before, but maybe 10 or 100 times. And this is how it looks underwater. So this was the first dive on this expedition. It was devastating, but so ecologically you can see that corals are growing over corals, right? So the coral cover is really high, but this whole reef just went through an episode of bleaching. And as I said, this is not where you can basically blame this to local factors because there were no local factors. So this is basically climate change is like everywhere. I just think this is a good illustration, right? You can basically not escape it. Okay, so this brings us to this graphic. It will get lighter at the end of the day, but I have to push you through this. So this coral bleaching was known, I think, for 50 or 100 years, but what was not known was mass coral bleaching events. The first one was actually observed in the Caribbean in the beginning of the 80s. So when I was a kid, this was essentially unknown to humankind. And then the first global event, so like you can pretty much see this map here. So everything that is red obviously is too hot. And this is actually a scale that shows you degree heating weeks. So I don't explain what that means, but it basically means it's the accumulated heat stress that triggers coral bleaching. So what you can see is that these events essentially increase in frequency and in intensity, and we just did a meta-analysis of this third global event. So 15,000 reefs were analyzed, 80% were bleached and 35% dead. Okay, so within the course of 3 years, you basically lose a third of your rainforest. It's, if that would happen above water, I think that would be pretty tragic. It's also known, as I said, that this climate change is really driving this bleaching. So there is a lot of things that you can make locally better, and you can reduce bleaching by that means, but you cannot completely escape it. So what's really at stake is that we lose this reef ecosystems. So here's the little graph from 2023, what's at stake right now, and you've also heard this in the news. So we have this El Nino year, which is an unusually warm water year. So now you have these warm waters plus the climate warming. And you heard that in the Caribbean, I mean, this was even in the Tagesschau news, that they are not doing well. And what happened right now in the Caribbean has nothing to do with the coming El Nino. The El Nino usually starts in the Pacific and then sweeps over, which you can nicely see here, and the reports are from here. But, and this was published in the New York Times, they literally took corals out of the water on land to rescue them. I mean, this, if that doesn't tell you that something is wrong, I don't know what. It would literally equate if you try to move elephants from the African whatever into a gym hall to cool them down. It doesn't work, basically. Okay, again, I think I don't have to convince you, but for the older people that are not here or maybe watch this later, so this is not whatever scientist horror scenario. This is IPCC, International Panel of Climate Change. This is politicians meet scientists meet stakeholders. And what little people know, A, you can all contribute to this, and B, it's a consensus document. So whatever finds its language in there was actually approved by the politicians, okay? So this is the watered down, diluted version of what you get. And what is verbatim in this report is that we are at very high risk, so 70 to 99% coral reef decline at the projected warming. Okay, so this is the consensus of everybody. It's not just me alarming you. Okay, so we have to do something about it, and then, okay, now we're getting, I hope I can now bring you back. We have to do something about it, but that in itself can also be overwhelming. What can I do? Blah, 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 and I will give you an answer, what we can do by the end of this talk. But in this case, do you know this guy? Well, this guy you know, that's me. This guy is the Prince Albert of Monaco, HSH, His Serene Highness, as we had to title him. But anyway, so he invited the coral reef people that he thought have to think about it, and that's actually good. We have so many Zoom meetings, sometimes you have to lock people in a room for 2 or 3 days and think about hard about stuff. So this is what we did here. And we came up with this paper, which actually really provided a very important perspective to me. So this was published in May 2021, Designing a Blueprint for Coral Reef Survival. So this was one of the most important figures that was actually really also instructive for me personally. So we basically modeled 4 scenarios, no emission, or high emission, no adaptation, and no adaptation means you do nothing else on top of it. Yeah, socio-ecological, economic, biological. We basically modeled the expected frequency of bleaching. So after I just told you the 3 global events in the course in time frame of 15 years, how would things look like if we go forward? So high CO2 emission, no adaptation, low CO2 emission, no adaptation, high emission with adaptation, low emission with adaptation. So you can already see, so no surprise, this high emission, no adaptation gets you nothing. It basically kills everything in 20 years. But low emissions and no adaptation will also not fix it. So even if we would roll it down to 0, it's just not good enough. And the 3 points that I take home from this, so the only way out is this, but I will talk about this a little bit more in a second. So, but you all attended math in school, for better or worse. I was always taught this notwendig und hinreichend. Are you familiar with this in Mathe? Okay, so climate, so curbing emissions is notwendig, but not hinreichend. Okay, it's absolutely essential, but it's insufficient on itself to conserve reefs. So you have to do something else. So basically, we need to innovate new ideas, and they need rapid development, as I said. So this is 20 years, okay? This is my chance to fix it and your chance to fix it. And after that, there is no chance anymore after us. But also what I put here, and I looked up these numbers this morning, so somehow we don't grasp the magnitude of effort that is required, but the US was very keen to put a man on the moon, and this entire program basically cost $25.8 billion, so $1 billion in 1960, which nowadays would equate to $257 billion inflation corrected. And the Biden administration, okay, the good guys, not the Republicans, just committed $16.5 billion to climate change over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. So that's 6% of the budget that it costs to bring a man on the moon. So, okay, this is how you have to put these numbers. So I think there's a lot more that we could do, but financially it's at a position that is not top priority. Okay, anyway, so low emissions with adaptation it is, okay, and I already told you that adaptations in this context of this modeling exercise, we very broadly defined it as biological, ecological, or socioeconomic interventions, right? And you know how it is. You also need to get the people to come with you or to convince. But they are indeed necessary partners to CO2 mitigation. Yeah, and I think this is actually good news, because I met people at conferences that told me they don't study corals because they will be dead by the time they have finished their PhD. So, like, somebody of you was with me? No, I think Luigi told me this on the Gordon conference. So we have to do this still, okay, even if all the other people do their stuff. And I also think it's okay that you do the change in your domain, okay? Nobody on their own can like solve this issue, but you can try to find how you make an impact in your domain. And I think if everybody agrees to that, then we can go big steps forward. So the three basic tools, so to say, in biology at our arsenal is conservation, which is the obvious thing, right? So if you don't destroy it, you don't have to rebuild it. So conservation number one. Restoration, you are familiar with that. I mean, 93% of European forests are restored, secondary forests, okay? Only 7% of what you see in Europe is original forest. So what does that tell you? I never thought this, and B, it can be done, okay? So the majority of forest we have in Europe is not original. And then we have this new kind of thinking, which is called rehabilitation. So very quickly, if you restore to a previous state that died, then it will die again because you're not removing all the factors, right? So putting the same corals that bleached in one position, the corals will just bleach again. So rehabilitation is this idea of restoration plus a factor X, and there's also a word that I really like, a microbiome rewilding. I don't know if you've heard this, we come to this later. Okay, but that's basically our objectives or job description, and I just told you there's whatever, 25 million species dependent on coral reefs, so how do you pick one and save the corals? Well, and that's actually a picture of a nice coral reef, as you might have guessed. This is in Australia, whatever, 15 years ago. They don't have the fishing problem, and that's the big difference, I think. But anyway, so corals are really these foundation species, you know, this ecological concept, right? It's a species that you cannot have the ecosystem without. So if you save the corals, you save the reefs. That's really the tagline, and I think it's true. And what we also know that there is bright spots, so reefs that are more resilient than expected, or that survive better, or that bleach less. I mean, you know how this is, right? You always find these things that just don't behave as expected. So this is kind of the first thing that you have to go for, right? Identify resilient reefs and corals and demark this as conservation zones, first of all. But how the hell do you do this? I just told you that corals don't grow in Lake Constance. Sponges do. But you basically need to bring the lab to the reef, and this is basically what we started thinking about 5 years ago. So we want something. I mean, of course you can do experiments, and experiments take time and cost money. somehow you want something like a cardiology stress test, right? So if your heart aches, the first thing you do is you go to your physician. He does an ECG on you, EKG, and if that reading looks weird, he sends you to a specialist. So that kind of was the thinking here, that we develop something very basic, but based on that we can make further claims and further experiments. And this is actually what we came up with. So sea bass, which is also a tasty fish, coral bleaching automated stress system. You can see Hannah and me, and this is a lot of the group that sits in front there. So the nice thing is you can basically bring it in two suitcases and you can set it up in a hotel room or apartment and run your experiment. Of course, I can also tell you it's much easier to ask for forgiveness after the fact than ask for permission before. Hotel owners are usually not keen to change their apartments into a lab. But I actually have little GoPro, what is that called, time lapses, where we change an entire apartment into a lab. So it looks very cool. Okay, but what we do here, you can basically see there's four different chambers. And that was really the idea. We essentially take corals and we put it on a racetrack and then we let them run and we check how quick they run. And the idea is that the ones that can run faster can also are better in a marathon. So the analogy being that whoever is better in this 20-hour test is also better during a natural bleaching event, which of course take days and weeks, right? This is the other thing we know from corals or from nature, that usually stuff takes time. And the second choice we made is rather than having this one control and treatment temperature, we actually did four temperatures, so which was actually a pretty smart choice looking back, because it really allows you to assess the performance at different temperatures, and that gets you a whole nother suit of analytics that you can essentially use. So a typical experiment takes 18 hours, and it's literally meant to simulate a day in the reef. So the coral wakes up, it gets warm, then it's very warm from 12 to 3, and then it cools down. We switch the light off, and they have this overnight reprieve or recovery. So you could even compare these two time points and measure the direct stress tolerance and how much they can recover from it. Unfortunately, this moved, so you cannot see this really, but we basically array these corals in crits, okay? And this is from the lowest temperature, so MMM is the long-term maximum mean summer temperature, and this is plus 9, and you can see that some whiten and others are dark. So alone by means of that, the idea is that corals or coral colonies that are represented by these fragments are more resilient than corals that are represented by these fragments. Okay, very easy. How do we collect this? We actually have an underwater drill. Looks like this. So you can also see that they slime a lot, but it literally takes 5 seconds. You get a little piece of a colony, and that is then representative. The nice thing is you can, of course, do this multiple times on the same colony, and then you have the same genotype that you can put into different experimental treatments. Right, so if you think about biology, typically you always change two things at a time. You change the condition and you change the genotype you're working with. It's why you have this isoclonal model system, so the genetics don't come into it. Okay, okay, how do we actually analyze this? So it's something you're good at biology if you can assemble stuff that other people have done, okay, or repurpose. So this ED50 is effective dose 50. And again, back to basics, we try to find a concept that people are familiar with. So you are all familiar with this LD50, lethal dose 50 from pharmacology. So the concentration of a drug at which 50% of the test animals die is the LD50. So the ED50 here was the idea that we basically set a temperature point at where you lose 50% of your initial performance, and you can see this here. So the red and blue dots are two different coral populations. The dots are the colonies, and you can see that we basically measure some performance across four different temperatures. So at the end, they all crash, which is intended. You really want to crash them, but you can see that the red corals from the red population can sustain much more temperature and keep this value up high, whereas corals from the blue population crash much earlier. And if you model this ED50, there's actually now an R package that we released for this. You can see that the temperature at where you have this inversion or inflection point is 34.74 for the population A and 37.24 for the population B. So that doesn't mean that you can basically expose them at this temperature for years or weeks, because then we wouldn't have a problem. But now you basically have a set point that you can compare, and you can say that these coral populations are basically 3 degrees apart. Yeah. So if you had to save one, you would probably save the red population. So we did a lot of work of this, because now you have this cookie cutter where you can basically take your system and go to different places. But again, you can build your own. You can put whatever you want in there, probably also fish. So then you can build this from hardware materials. So this was very intended, that this is the opposite of sophisticated. Okay, this is not rocket science. But you can do it a lot, and you can do it very standardized. So in 2018, we wanted to put things to the test. So I, as I said, I was busy in the Red Sea. So we basically drove along the Red Sea. And you can see this here. At one point, we took the wrong turn to Mecca. Okay, so non-Muslims are not allowed there. So the police came after us and non-Muslim. And they were asking us if we have Google Maps or not. And then they sent us in the right direction. So no problem, but basically traveled along the Red Sea coast. And the Red Sea is one of the warmest seas, and it also has a very steep temperature gradient, which you can see here. So north is coldest, south is warmest. So we collected at, as I said, across this gradient, and then we measured with this little seabass thing. And then we found something pretty remarkable. First of all, that corals are typically very acclimated or adapted to their local summer. So if you go to places where the summer historically is colder, they have a lower thermal tolerance than to go to places where the summer is warmer, which makes sense. But then you also have something where it just peaks, okay? So the average expectation would be that you find some, whatever, 6.5 degrees above MMM. But in the northern Red Sea, this really peaked. And then, of course, the New York Times took this and exploited it in its usual or non-usual manner. But if you would basically take the corals from this site and project it when they would bleach, they have essentially 200-year climate change insurance, which sounds great. But of course, if you've ever been there, you literally stand at the ocean, you look down to Egypt, you look down to Jordan, you look down to Saudi Arabia. It's a tiny stretch that everybody fights for, as you know. So the problem here is really local. It's pretty much impossible to save these corals, but the problem of these corals is not climate change. Okay, but what we can do now is we can basically plot our ED50 against this mean maximum summer temperature. And as I just told you, they end up on a line, right? So the warmer the summer is, the more thermally tolerant the corals are, which kind of makes sense. But then you can also see things that are on this corner, and those are the outliers. So they have a higher thermal tolerance than expected from the environment, right? So that scientifically would be then one way to basically look for coral reef bright spots. And in November 2022, we were in Guam in our super pink rash guards. So you can see, I mean, there's no point diving here. These corals basically live in 1 meter underwater. And you have empty beaches, but we here you can see we actually needed to extend the press of these corals. So these corals are amazingly temperature resistant. If you would plot it again against our graphs, they also peak. So this indeed seems to be a pattern. Right, so what we developed based on this is that you basically, you cannot save all reefs, but you need to save some. And then, of course, as I told you, there's never enough money for this type of thing. So where do you actually put your money? well, you want to identify the super reefs and super corals, and this using these rapid thermal assays is one way to do it, essentially. So what I talked to you so far is basically this. This allows you to develop a conservation map. You can basically designate bright spots, right? And these are basically corals that exhibit a higher thermal tolerance than they need to have by their local conditions. And of course, you can also zoom in and find corals that are extremely resilient as source material for restoration. So this vision turned into a mission, and this also again reads great. I think in May 2021 or 2022, we got the big bucks from Paul G. Allen, who's the co-founder of Microsoft. Okay, so you have to find money at the billionaires club of philanthropes, and this is not very developed in Germany. It's very developed in the US. So much of this stuff in the US is paid by private people. I think we should get the Aldi Brüder to donate a billion to this. But anyway, so you really have to think about it. For a billionaire, 10 million is nothing. It's seriously less, whatever, it's 0.1% of their whatever. But, so this is good, but yeah, what I wanted to say is that it's not that you present this idea and then they say, hey, it's great, we give you 6 million. No, what happened is they first invited me for a scoping meeting for 2 days, and we were pretty much shut down, that the coral people don't know their shit and this is all not happening. But this was the open door, and then we did this in the summer, and then I called them that I think I have something that will basically convince them, and then we started talking for 2 years and finally we got the money. Okay, so general thing, you need to be a freaking bristle guy that never lets go until you have it in science, okay? This is this soft skill. If you don't develop this as a researcher, you will never get it. Okay, but these thermal stress assays are actually become very popular. So a lot of people on this planet now use it, or in coral reef science, which is great. This was also in DFG Forschung, if you want to read more about it. But as I said, there's also there's conservation, restoration, and then there's rehabilitation. And rehabilitation, if you think about it, the way to go is really through means of microbiome. So who knows? Who doesn't know is unfair to ask. Everybody knows what the microbiome is. So the microbiome is the entity or sum of all microbes that are associated with all organisms. It's basically a new understanding. So every animal, plant, or fungi is essentially associated with bacteria, and these bacteria are not noise or contamination. They are actually really functionally important. This goes very far, essentially in California, where personalized medicine goes essentially through bacterial gut microbiome, okay? But a lot of the diseases we face nowadays, like metabolic syndrome and so on, has a lot to do with the microbiome, and how our microbiome looks very different from it should look like. So it's not different in coral. So if we now look at this coral meta-organism, it's actually this algae, as I showed you before, and the associated bacteria, and then there's a ton of other organisms that we have no idea what they are doing. But we did one study in 2017 where I think we actually showed this or illustrated this very well. Again, corals are awesome because you can fragment them into different pieces, okay, and then you can do this twin study design experiment. So you know how valuable identical twins are to medicine? It's because you have different environments and the identical genotypes. So corals are basically pre-built. You can fragment them and then you can always, so it gives you immense power to do stuff. So we basically found two reef sites that are very close by, HV and MV, highly and moderately variable, and they were different with bleaching susceptibility. So the highly variable coral were essentially these hardened beasts that you could not kill, and the moderately variable corals were basically very sensitive to thermal tolerance. So we basically took 20 colonies, fragmented them, back transplanted them, and transplanted them in the new environment. And after 17 months, you basically couldn't differentiate them based on the microbiome. So the microbiome completely adapted to the environment, which in itself is not so surprising anymore 6 years later. But what we then tested were the corals with this HV coral microbiome, okay? So these are the corals that came out of the shitty environment that only changed their microbiome. If you then put them on the treadmill, and you can see this is actually the first published CBAS profile in 2017, that we didn't call it back then that, but the microbiome was essentially indicative of the thermal tolerance. So these corals that were formerly not very resilient with their new microbiome, they were much more resilient. And this was cool, and this is, was hope, and this inspired, for instance, this perspective, where we put down the different things of how organisms or corals in this part can actually adapt to climate change, right? You have this slow Darwinian evolution, which essentially requires selection over generations. But these corals are really prototype meta-organisms, so they are very reliant on their microorganisms, and at least bacteria you can manipulate very well. I think, I mean, I don't know if I should say hopefully, but all of you probably have transformed E. coli. So this is something that they almost do in school now, okay? But this is one thing, what this really then, I basically led the writing of another review in 2021. The question you really have to ask if is conservation and restoration is enough, and I know this is a hot topic and I'm happy to debate it, but okay, to be explicit about it, what the way this is going means that you do probiotic or microbial therapy, so you actually inoculate corals with bacteria to increase their resilience, and this sounds of course horrible at first, but we did this proof of principle study, so Raquel was leading that. What we basically did is we had corals with and without heat stress and with a placebo bacteria and with these beneficial bacteria. So what I have to say is that these beneficial bacteria are bacteria from this species that you isolate from coral colonies that are fitter than others, and then you give it back, okay? It's not that you bring in experimentally evolved or unnatural bacteria into this. So these are bacteria that were there to begin with, and, okay, I'll say some more about this in a second, but it was actually pretty amazing what got out of this. So again, this is freaking, we have no idea what we're doing. We put these bacteria on the coral and you increase survival by 40%, okay? I mean, this is an effect size that you kill for in biology, typically of 3 to 5%. So this really works. And as I said, so this is what we call nature-based solution. There's also a lot of new terms that are invented right now, and there's also a lot of money that goes to questionable things, but this idea that you have probiotic or beneficial bacteria that you isolate from healthy donor colonies and you give it to affected recipients, this is actually exactly what they do in human medicine, and it's called MTT, microbial transfer therapy. And this was the, how do you say, the golden child of medicine, and then one person died 2 months ago. Like before, it was always considered this is super benign, the worst case is that it doesn't work. Now one person died, so apparently it's not so untricky to just transfer bacteria. So there are some things that we don't understand that we have to understand. But this is Raquel and me underwater. And what she actually set up is a probiotic village. So this is now in situ. And there's probably the only place where you can do this is the Red Sea in Saudi Arabia, because the regulations are pretty like light, let's say. But as I said, it's not that we bring something into the reefs that wasn't there to begin with, but you can pretty much see what happened. So the this picture here is 2021, and this is 2022, and this is 2023. So this is happening right now, okay? But what she did is she actually inoculated colonies regularly. You can see, I mean, this is also kind of debatable how much you can scale this. You literally need to go underwater with your little syringe full of bacteria, and then you apply it to the coral, and you put a little bag over it, and then you let it incubate. So I would have never thought this worked, but it did work. So what they see, and this is now unpublished, but this is, they basically treated some colonies for a year and others not. So this, first of all, and this is important, you cannot basically find this bacteria outside the coral, and we have very sensitive methods to measure that. You can find them in the coral, which is good, but it also makes sense, right? I mean, if you put a giraffe in Constance, it would also not survive. It's not its natural environment. So these bacteria live in coral, they don't live in the water. But what she also found is that this probiotic-treated coral exhibit less paling, better physiology, and higher survival. I mean, eventually everything dies, right, if you cook it. But if you're interested in this topic, this is actually a good podcast, I think. So probiotics for corals, I think Science Town, there's this whole splash of ideas, all the stuff you could do. Okay, but again, I basically told you this, so technically we don't know what we're doing, or I mean, we do know what we're doing, we don't know why it works, or we don't know how it works. So this probiotics is really a best guess. You basically estimate traits that may make a difference, for example, reactive oxygen species depletion, and then you screen. So back to square one, where I come from, we need a model system. And this model system is Aptasia. So back in 2015, we sequenced the genome. And we got a lot of shit for this from the coral people because they like their coral, and I get it. You want to swim in a reef, but you also want to advance the science. So I think this is something of the past. Everybody agrees now. But so back in the Red Sea, we did a lot to basically establish that. So we have the genome, the microbiome is characterized. We know how to get the microbes off. And this is basically things that you can put in a little box of seawater, and they are just happy and crow. So here's our roadmap. So how can we want to test the functional potential for this bacteria. We want to know how they are beneficial and what they do and where they colonize importantly. So this is done work mostly done by Melanie, Chia, and Lea. Also, Luigi is a bit involved in this, but okay, this is maybe too much, but we're working on it, okay? Like, this is actually nice and complementary, and I also think this is a good way. You don't need to sacrifice corals from the reef for this type of thing. This is basic cellular biology. This is supposed to work the same in all cnidarians. So I think this is really exciting and also complementary, and it's the right approach to do it. So almost on the mark, 45 minutes. So basically there's three things, right? Conservation, restoration. So first of all, you can identify these bright spots and designate this for conservation. And did you hear about this 30 by 30? So 30% of the ocean is basically a no-take zone by 2030. Like, I think this is a great initiative that we should all support. And then, as somebody denoted it, X-Men or X-Woman, okay, women, there's always colonies that are more resilient than others. Even if we don't know why they are, it's relatively easy to identify them. And then, of course, as I said, these probiotics, at one point, we have to decide if we want to keep the panda alive or not, right? I mean, a panda bear in a Chinese zoo is not a panda population, but if you lose that, everything is gone. So I think there is a case to be made for this kind of stuff. Okay, so most of the time, and this is a horrible analogy that you should never apply in science, but you basically have to build the airplane while flying it when it comes to climate change, I think. Okay, and with that, I thank you, also my lab and the people that give me money. Shameless self-plug, if you're interested in genomics, we actually, for the first time, organized this. again, I don't know if this is good or bad. It's, I don't know how intensive it is, but it's a 1 week, but you literally start from the organism, we sequence it on these little USB sequencers, and you assemble and annotate it. So, and again, this is at a financial footprint. If you want to go rogue, technically you can buy this stuff, go into the Amazon jungle and sequence whatever you want. Okay, so we teach you how in the course of a week. You need a good laptop. Okay, and yeah, thanks for your attention. I'm happy to take any questions.
Ich hätte eine Frage.
Ja.
Auf Deutsch.
Ja.
So geht's.
Bitte.
Was kann ich jetzt genau tun für dieses Thema? Also sozusagen als Person, die.
Okay. Also die beiden unteren Sachen finde ich vor allem wichtig. Ja, das ist natürlich, kannst du nicht direkt was für Climate Change tun, aber ich glaube, es ist amazing. Du bist total in einem Glashaus in der Uni, weil du immer mit Leuten redest, die sowieso schon das denken, was du denkst. Also du gehst raus und es gibt super Confusion, even about the most basic facts. Also ich denke, eine unserer Aufgabe ist wirklich, leg dir passende Sachen zusammen, so wie zum Beispiel diese Mondlandung. Ja? Das sind so Zahlen, das ist faktisch, die kann niemand refuten, aber das zeigt dir halt mal, wie sehr uns das angeht oder die Politik angeht. Ich denke, solche so drei Dinge, die man sich zurechtlegt, die jetzt nicht damit zu tun haben, dass CO2-Emissionen in der Atmosphäre und Sonneneinstrahlung, sondern einfach, wie viel Geld wir dafür ausgeben oder wie viel das kostet und so Kram. Das, denke ich, ist gut. Und auch dieser andere Effekt, und also der liegt mir am Herzen, also man geht in die Uni, um sich anderen Meinungen auszusetzen, ja, und Teil der Exercise ist, dass du dir auch Kram anhörst, mit dem du nicht übereinstimmst und dann eine Diskussion hast. Ja, und dass wir auch wieder rausgehen und mit Leuten diskutieren darüber. Das ist alles so elfenbeinturmmäßig immer noch. Das geht mir ziemlich auf den Wecker. Ja, also ihr seid die Experten, okay? Natürlich kann jeder eine Meinung haben, aber ich fange ja auch nicht an, mit dem Pilot zu diskutieren, ob ich besser weiß, wie man ein Flugzeug fliegt. Also das ist meine Domain of Expertise und ihr dürft euch eure Domain of Expertise nicht nehmen lassen. Ja, es gibt einen Unterschied zwischen everybody can have an opinion and everybody is right.
Ja, also man redet ja immer davon, dass Korallen irgendwie nicht in der Lage sind, sich anzupassen. Ist das so komplett faktisch? Weil ich finde es so, also es hat ja einen ewig langen Zeitraum der Evolution gegeben und es gab auch unfassbar warme Perioden.
Ja.
Gibt es da irgendwelche, oder macht ihr dazu auch irgendwas, das untersucht?
Also ich weiß jetzt, ja, sprich mal zu Ende, sorry.
Ob es Population oder ob es Korallen gibt, die sich halt auch in irgendeiner Weise anpassen können, weiß ich, Genexpressionsmuster, Veränderungen oder sowas. Keine Ahnung, vielleicht habt ihr da irgendwas.
Ja, also da sind wir genau schon in dem, was ich gerade gesagt habe. Also natürlich sind alle Korallen angepasst. Also ich habe dir ja gerade gezeigt, dass die unterschiedliche Temperaturtoleranzen haben, je nachdem, wo du sie findest. Die Notion und das ist, oder die generelle Idee ist, dass die Erde sich schneller ändert, als Organismen sich anpassen können. Aber da gibt es mittlerweile auch Studien, dass Korallen sind keine Ausnahme. Die Korallen sind nur die ersten, wo du siehst. Also es gibt auch die Idee, wenn man das nicht schaffen, ja, und das weißt du, irgendwann stumpft man ab. Du lässt jetzt ein Ökosystem über die Klippe gehen und beim nächsten tut es schon nicht mehr so weh. Also das ist die Gefahr, die ich sehe, dieses Ignorieren und dann stumpfst du halt ab und irgendwann akzeptierst du, dass wir alle aus einer Flasche atmen und irgendwie aus einem Fläschchen essen. Also das sehe ich, also generell ist es so, dass der Wandel schneller stattfindet, als die meisten Organismen sich anpassen können, aber es ist auch so, und das hat man jetzt halt während Covid gesehen, also die Natur kann ultra schnell und gut backbouncen, ja, wenn man sie lässt, also das ist, und irgendwie haben wir heutzutage nicht mehr die Fähigkeit, zwei Gedanken gleichzeitig in unserem Kopf zu formen, ja. Also Klimawandel ist ein Problem, aber lokal ist auch ein Problem und das ist halt verschachtelt. Also du kannst Klimawandel schwächer machen, wenn du lokal besser machst und du kannst quasi Klimawandel stärker machen, wenn du lokal schlechter machst. Also ich gehe auch in Länder, die kein Geld haben und bei denen sehen die Riffe schlecht aus, weil sie halt komplett überfischt sind, aber die dann sagen, ja, ist alles Climate Change, ja, ist nicht alles Climate Change. Also man muss das halt differenziert sehen und wie gesagt, man kann immer was machen und alles, was ich jetzt gesagt habe, das ist gar nicht so wichtig. Der Punkt ist, wir werden viel verlieren, aber die Choice ist, ob du alles verlierst oder ob du noch was übrig hast, was dann wieder zurückwachsen kann. Ja, das ist auch wieder keine Entweder-Oder-Entscheidung. Und alles, was wir machen, kauft uns Zeit. Und alles, was uns Zeit kauft, ist probably gut, weil ich denke schon, dass wir irgendwann carbon neutral werden müssen.
So, you were talking about the probiotics and how it's like a single colony that you inoculate and then you put a plastic bag around it. How scalable do you think it is? Like, if we were to find a significant relationship, and if we were to find that it actually makes a difference and we understand why it makes a difference for reefs that are devastated, how scalable do you think it is?
Yeah, not scalable, but the point is that they also save the panda bear, right? So the way I see it, it's a band-aid, and if you have this super value reef, then it's probably worth the effort, like, right? Then it really becomes a question of how much money do you lose economically or ecologically, and how much money does it cost? And in that instance, I think it's okay. There's also actually ways we already work on how to distribute this better. I mean, for example, you can design organic tapes that you can literally like a transect tape in the reef, and that slowly diffuses this probiotic organism, since now we know that it's apparently not alive outside of corals. You can actually don't have to apply it on the coral itself, but let it find its way to the coral. So it will always be a niche solution, but I think it has its use cases. But again, it's a very differentiated opinion, right? And if I go to a talk show and then, oh, Wolstra said probiotics can save reefs, or Wolstra said it's not worse, we don't have to, like, really stand in for differentiated opinions. Just stuff is complex. If it wouldn't be complex, we wouldn't sit here and discuss it, and we had a solution, okay? And complexity requires different talking points. Like, it's really not black-white, I think. Danke.